Well, now to this unwanted companion that's been with us for millennia, malaria. The persistence of the malaria plasmodium, it's not quite a parasite, it's something slightly different, continues to have an enormous effect on the lives of millions, continues being the operative word. Indeed, some would argue that it's influenced the health of humans, but also the rise and fall of peoples, of cities, and the outcome of war. Well, my next guest has specifically traced the history of the Australian Army's struggle to understand the causes, transmission and prevention of malaria in deployments overseas. The history is fascinating and devastating because, of course, from a soldier's point of view, there must be almost nothing worse than feeling the lick of fever and weakness and aches that malaria causes just as you're going into battle. So let's go to this military medical battle. Ian Howie-Willis is the author of An Unending War, The Australian Army's Struggle Against Malaria from 1885 to 2015. Welcome, Ian.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Early in the book, Ian, malaria is described like a second enemy in any operational service, whether it be combat or peacekeeping or a humanitarian response. And I really like that description because it makes you feel immediately alert to a really a parallel battle in a way, doesn't it?
Particularly in malarious regions, which are most of the regions to which the Australian Defence Forces are deployed. It's present, and if it's not controlled, it can decimate a defence force very quickly.
Well, in fact, I think one of the contributors to your book says, malaria can defeat armies as surely as armies defeat each other.
Yes, that's correct. And if you want a good example of that, you only have to look at Papua New Guinea during World War II. The Allies, that is the Australians and Americans, controlled malaria successfully. The Japanese didn't. And that was one of the major factors in their eventual defeat. And it's estimated that they lost about 10% of their armies killed by malaria.
So let's look back before we turn to recent history. When in history do we become aware that malaria is a disease that devastates humans?
Well, yes, certainly the ancient texts in China, in India, in Egypt, give fairly accurate descriptions of malaria. And of course, the ancient Greek physicians described it very well. So it's been known about and its effects have been understood really for millennia, even though the causes were not so well known.
Mm. And do historians know which military campaigns have really been dramatically affected by malaria? I mean campaigns before the two world wars, let's say 19th century and earlier.
Well, going back in history, it's one of the reasons that said why Alexander the Great didn't go on and conquer India. He only got into the Ganges Valley. And then there was something of a revolt among his commanders. They said, we've gone far enough. We want to go back home. And it's thought that the sickness that they are experiencing, probably malaria, was what forced that decision. And it's thought that Alexander himself ultimately died of the disease. If he wasn't actually poisoned, he possibly had malaria.
How interesting. I didn't know that. You're primarily concerned about how Australian military medical staff coped and learned how to fight malaria. And this is what you've really plunged yourself into for years researching. I was amazed to read about the amount of work the soldiers had to do to avoid being bitten by mosquitoes in the Jordan Valley, say, during World War One. Could you tell us about that, please?
The Australian troops and their British and Indian allies were forced to spend the summer of 1918 in the Jordan Valley. They were, of course, fighting the Ottoman Empire, that is, the Turks. The Australians perhaps drew the short straw. They were stationed in the Jordan Valley near present-day Jericho. The Jordan at that time was one of the most malarious places on earth. The wadis, they're called, the little creeks coming in off the Judean and Moab plateaus, meandered down to the Jordan across a huge swampy area. the inhabitants, the local Bedouins, they got out of the place for the, for the summer. The Australians were forced to stay there. So the head of the Australian Medical Services, Colonel Rupert Downes, as he was then, he decided that if the Australians were to stay there, they would be decimated by malaria unless it was controlled. And so they undertook huge engineering works to drain the swamps, to cut back the vegetation that protected the mosquitoes.
And I'm going to interrupt you there, because there's so much interesting detail you've uncovered. He also began a trial of quinine on two of the Australian Light Horse regiments. And what was interesting was his behavioural efforts too, because he issued mosquito nets to all the troops, didn't he? But he had to really watch them closely, because the troops regarded taking these sorts of preventive measures as effeminate and unsoldierly. So he had to really change their mindsets.
What Downes was implementing is what has become known as malaria discipline. You sleep under a mosquito net, you wear a mosquito net from your slouch hat, you wear gloves at night, you roll down your sleeves, you button up your shirt, and that gives you a modicum of protection against the malarial mosquitoes. Not only did they regard it as effeminate, they saw it as a distraction. If you're going to be attacked in the night by your enemy, you don't want
to get... You don't want a mosquito net around you.
indeed.
Yes.
And so malaria discipline has historically been very unpopular among frontline troops and their commanders.
So when did these sorts of efforts to prevent malaria in World War One fail? Because, I mean, that was actually very, very successful, this complex sort of effort of his. But was there an epidemic?
Well, there certainly was. They kept the troops relatively malaria-free for that time in the Jordan Valley because they'd controlled the environment. But when in September, October, the command came to take Damascus, they were then moving into what was still highly malarious territory north of the Sea of Galilee, Lake Tiberias, and into Syria. So as soon as they went into the area, they started getting bitten by mosquitoes. The incubation period is 2 to 3 weeks, and that was the time that it took them to get from Lake Tiberias up to Damascus.
And many thousands of troops on both sides, didn't they, fell ill, including many of the doctors. And as I'm reading your book, you say the combination of malaria and influenza was especially lethal. And the Australian death toll from malaria was 134, more than had died in the fighting.
Unfortunately for those who fell victim, the great worldwide pandemic of Spanish influenza, that broke upon them at the same time. And the peculiar effect of both the influenza and falciparum malaria, it's called, that's the lethal variety, they each feed off the other and have a worse effect than if the victim was experiencing only one of those diseases. Mm. That was particularly lethal.
Let me just tell people, Ian Howie-Willis is my guest. He's written a book called The Unending War, The Australian Army's Struggle Against Malaria. It, in fact, partly anyway, celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Australian Army Malaria Institute. It was established in 1966 to build on the specialised knowledge and experience that the Army possessed. And it's really quite an extraordinary story. So often, Ian, military insights can advance technology and knowledge. You detail how the two men who won Nobel Prizes for their work on malaria, including the discovery that it was transmitted from human to human by mosquitoes, that they were both army physicians. So I'm wondering if more was understood about the treatment or prevention of malaria after World War One, because in World War Two, so many of our troops head into malaria zones.
The comment that you've made that armies seem to be susceptible to malaria is why a lot of malaria research has actually been done by army medical officers and army scientific officers. And in the modern era, many armies like our own have their own malaria institutes. Malaria does remain a disease that affect military personnel. For example, the Australian soldier coming out of malaria-free Australia, going into, say, Afghanistan or Iraq or East Timor, is going to be susceptible unless he or she practices malaria discipline, which includes the taking of the best and latest of anti-malarial medication. So armies are particularly susceptible to it, particularly if they come from an area where malaria is not known.
Well, quite. And the whole business of the tactics, you can have a whole lot of tactics employed and then suddenly your army, as it's put it, evaporates out of illness because it suddenly comes on, these sort of big sweats and so on. So it's a clear and present danger, isn't it?
It is. And we can see what the effects of what you've just described in the Australian Army in Papua New Guinea in World War II, when Japan entered the war and invaded the Australian territories in Papua New Guinea at the beginning of 1942, Australian troops were rushed there. Soon they started coming down with malaria. It was endemic among the village people. And what often happens is that you have a reservoir of malaria-infected blood. And that was originally the indigenous population, but very soon it included the Australian military population as well. Mm. So Australia entered a series of malaria epidemics in 1942, while the famous battle along the Kokoda Track was taking place, while Milne Bay was being fought. Later, while Boona and Gona, those campaigns were being fought, Australians were experiencing a huge epidemic of malaria.
Because, for instance, you make the point that all the POWs captured by the Japanese in Changi, all of them had malaria.
Oh, not only did they have malaria, they had multiple bouts of it. It was virtually impossible to avoid. If you were in the Changi camp, or if you were worse on the Burma-Thailand railway, you were going to get malaria and you were going to probably get end-on attacks of it. There's a fair chance that it would kill you, even if the other tropical diseases and overwork and brutality didn't.
Mm. Let's move forward. What is now the standard treatment for Australian troops in malaria zones? Because over the century we've been discussing, some strains of malaria have developed drug resistance, haven't they?
And in fact, the wonder drug that enabled the Australians and Americans to defeat the Japanese in Papua New Guinea was a drug called Atibrin that they started using in 1943 and used consistently from 1944. There was a remarkable Australian Malaria Research Institute based at Cairns which experimented with Atibrin using volunteers from the army, and they determined the dosages required to keep soldiers in the field. And it enabled the Australians and Americans to fight those final campaigns and defeat the Japanese. But by the end of the war, Atibrin-resistant malaria was emerging. And the reason they had is that the Japanese also had Atibrin, but they used it inconsistently. And if you're using a drug like that, you can't use it inconsistently.
No.
And so that was the first known instance of drug-resistant malaria parasites. It emerged again during the Malayan emergency of the late 1950s and early 60s, and most notably in Vietnam. By that stage, the drug of choice was called Paludrin.
Can I ask you, there's quite a controversy around the use of mefloquine or larium, which is the name it's commonly known by, a newer drug. There's been some controversy about the army's prescription of this drug to soldiers in East Timor. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on that are sadly that issue hadn't arisen when I wrote the book, but I'm not trying to evade your question, Geraldine, but I'm a social historian. I'm not a malariologist or a pharmacologist.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm.
And it's a fairly recent issue. I'll just say that perhaps in another 10 years' time, if I'm ever called on to produce a second edition of the book, well, obviously I'm going to have to cover that issue then.
Yeah, and I suppose you might also argue that even though this is definitely, you know, something that is being decided at the moment, because some of the soldiers are very concerned about it, the Australian soldiers, but there's been a zero malaria mortality rate among 36,850 personnel across 25 years of post-war deployments. So that is quite some achievement, isn't it?
Oh, it's a fantastic achievement. The last Australian soldier who died from malaria, I think it was in 1967, if I'm not mistaken, and there are only two who died from malaria during that whole Vietnam involvement. It was a tremendous achievement.
Ian, I think you've really contributed something to Australian history, and I thank you very much for your time and congratulate you.
Thanks very much, Geraldine.
And that was Ian Howie-Willis, who's an historian and the author of An Unending War, The Australian Army Struggle Against Malaria. It's published by Big Sky Publishing, and it really will surprise you, I think. It's quite a history.
Do you guys have Barramundi here?
This is Mike and Timothy,
potato scallops,
the unlikely hosts of a new RN podcast. It's called The Real Thing.
Oh, my, you skipped over too high.
Stories.
Intimate stories, scenes, characters, places.
Born of Australia.
We're heading out into the corners to find the real Australia.
The Real Thing.
That's us here.
Subscribe now.